I was born 100,000 years ago, and there's nothing in this world I do not know. Why the flag started flying when George Washington stopped lying, I can lick the man who says that isn't so.
Welcome to Heritage Unbounded. I'm Sarah Chacon, your host and associate director of the Cultural Heritage Management Graduate Program at Johns Hopkins University. We're excited to be talking today with Dr. Steve Lansing. Dr. Lansing is co-director of the Complexity Institute and a professor in the Asian School of the Environment at Nanyang Technological University in Singapore, which is where Steve is joining us from today. He's an emeritus professor of anthropology at the University of Arizona, a senior research fellow at the Stockholm Resilience Center, an external professor at the Santa Fe Institute and the Vienna Complexity Hub, and president of the Anthropology and Environment Society of the American Anthropological Association. Before moving to Arizona in 1998, Dr. Lansing held joint appointments at the University of Michigan in the School of Natural Resources and Environment and the Department of Anthropology, and earlier chaired the Anthropology Department at the University of Southern California. He has been a fellow at the Institute for Advanced Study at Princeton, the Center for Advanced Study in the Behavioral Sciences at Stanford, the Institute of Advanced Study at Durham University, and the ICAM Institute for Molecular Biology in Jakarta. Steve's recent research in Indonesia has to do with adaptive self-organized criticality in coupled socio-ecological systems and co-phylogenies of languages and genes in the islands. In 2012, Steve worked on the nomination of Bali as a UNESCO World Heritage Site. These efforts developed out of his study of the Subaks and water temple networks of Bali and was the key to the World Heritage Site's eventual designation. Steve has graciously agreed to chat with us today as we talk a bit about the UNESCO nomination process, the subsequent impacts on site management in Bali, and the future of Bali's cultural landscapes. So welcome, Steve. Why don't we get started with a little context for our listeners? Can you tell us about your work with the UNESCO nomination for the cultural landscapes of Bali Province and a bit about how you came to be involved in the process?
Yeah, well, I should confess I knew nothing about World Heritage. I'm just an anthropologist who worked in Bali, written some books about Bali, and had lots of Balinese friends. But someone from ICAMOS, the International Commission on Monuments and Sites, came to visit me in England and asked me about helping them develop yet another attempt to create a World Heritage nomination for Bali. And in particular, it was meant to be focused on the cultural landscape, on the way in which the Balinese villages manage their rice terraces, which is something I've written a lot about. Anyway, so I said, yes, but I don't know anything about World Heritage. And she said, yes, but do you think that the world that you've been writing about will still exist in a few more decades unless something happens, because the tide of tourism and globalization is so enormous in Bali, and a World Heritage might be exactly what they need. So anyway, she was very convincing, a wonderful woman named Susan Denier of ICAMOS. And then, more or less by coincidence, or maybe not coincidence, the Indonesian ambassador to UNESCO asked me to help them write a nomination document. They tried four times, and all the previous nominations had failed. So I got busy and started working with UNESCO and with Balinese colleagues to try to come up with a plan that might actually work. So that's how that started. That's 2011. And by 2012, we'd written a document, and UNESCO approved it in 2012. So a World Heritage came into existence in Bali.
Well, that's fantastic. You mentioned something about cultural landscape and the living heritage site for Bali. Can you explain a little bit about what you mean in terms of a cultural landscape as opposed to sort of a built site or monument? What makes this a cultural landscape and what makes it living heritage?
Sure. Well, what I learned when I started to do this is that UNESCO distinguishes between what they call charmingly dead monuments, like Angkor Wat, and then there are biospheres, of course, but the other category is cultural landscape, and that's meant to be some landscape that humans have improved by their presence, and it's meant to have something that UNESCO calls outstanding universal value. So Bali, really, it made a lot of sense for them to want to have a World Heritage cultural landscape in Bali because there's a tradition in Bali of managing the landscape that they've created. I mean, the reasons why Bali has drawn so many visitors, it's just beautiful, and they've terraced their volcanoes and created a spectacular agriculture and architecture. and managed it with democratic assemblies, you know, at the village level, by democratic assemblies, and their references to the institutions that do that from the 12th century on. So it means that the average Balinese has more experience with direct democracy than the average American or the average Frenchman. I mean, it's an ongoing tradition. It's beautiful. I have to keep saying that. And what they emphasize, the Balinese chose the theme for the World Heritage.
Okay.
And the theme they chose was Trihita Karana. It means the three causes of goodness, basically. And what that means is the relationship, a harmonious relationship between humans and the natural world and the world of the spirit. So the Balinese have these rituals, their water temples, their networks of temples, where they get together and they make decisions about the management of water. Water is the gift of a goddess who lives in the crater lakes. And they cooperate with each other, and they think a lot about how to harmonize human activities with the natural world, and to acknowledge their indebtedness to the natural world and to one another, actually. So it sort of was meant to be. I mean, UNESCO mm-hmm. did not have to ponder how is anybody going to manage this, because the mm-hmm. Balinese already have a principle.
Mm-hmm.
They say the principle is, in Balinese, it's Simitone Sane Pungampon Jagapaniki, which means the families who have the inherited responsibility to manage this part of the earth, this part of the world. That's the responsibility. And there's no question about it. It's something that's inherited. You're tied to it. And so the management of families in their world is the basis for Trihita Karana, the three causes of goodness. And thus, it was the basis for the World Heritage. The idea was that this principle, Balinese would like to think this is a principle that would be worth celebrating
mm-hmm.
by UNESCO.
Mm-hmm.
They like that idea. I mean, they chose that as the foundation of the project.
Well, that's wonderful. Well, and it sounds like just by nature of the system, a management is already in place for the continuation of the... So this strikes me as a fairly unique instance where there was a lot of input and collaboration with local communities. Is that true?
Yeah, I mean, we my Balinese colleagues and I went and talked with the heads of the... There was an institution called a subak in Bali. That's all the people who share water from the same source and farm it, and they regard that as a gift from the goddess. So we talked to the elected heads of the subaks and came up with a plan for the creation of the World Heritage, including also the major temples where the rites of the goddess, for the goddess of waters and other gods and goddesses associated with the natural world. Anyway, where those things come together. Then nothing had to be invented from the Balinese standpoint. This is what they were already doing.
Right,
The purpose of the World Heritage was to give them a way to control or have some more control over essentially globalization. I mean, there's something like 2 million tourists a year who come to Bali. It's not well regulated. It's growing very quickly. So, and the Balinese are very welcoming and courteous people. So the problem is, as they say, Bali's being in danger of being loved to death.
Oh no!
Just too many visitors. So the notion of the World Heritage is to empower a governing assembly,
Dewan
Pengelola, which means a governing assembly of the elected heads of these villages and subaks and then from the water temples, to give them some additional powers
mm-hmm.
to manage the heritage properties. And extending their powers a little further, making the government agencies that have to do with things like agriculture and religion
mm-hmm.
advisory to the governing assembly.
That
was the idea. That was the basis for a management plan.
So that because it's an existing functioning system, the benefit then of the UNESCO nomination and the UNESCO designation is this increase opportunity for local population to have some more control in how they manage the site and manage visitors to
Right, and take advantage of the resources of tourism, because it's tough to be a rice farmer, and they were getting very little benefit from the tourists. So this is a way in which the people in the sites could decide sort of what they'd like to show, when they'd like tourists to arrive, when they would prefer them not to be there, and how the sites would be developed.
How has that changed since? So 2012 isn't too long ago. Are you seeing some benefit from the designation?
No, because things that plan was never implemented.
Okay.
What happened was the government decided that they wanted to sort of reconsider the management plan, and all of the different government agencies, I mean, from top down, from the national level to the various local levels, wanted to have a hand in the management of the World Heritage Sites. So fair enough, but the problem is that the governing assembly was never called into existence.
Okay.
And so the management plan was never implemented, and it's become chaotic. There's kind of a land grab going on in the World Heritage areas. There's uncontrolled development. UNESCO warned Indonesia a couple of times in their reports, their assessment, which is on the web, actually, the UNESCO World Heritage assessments, that they needed to implement World Heritage Management Plan.
Mm-hmm.
That hasn't happened. So now what's just happened is that representatives of several villages have requested that new regulations empower the governing assembly, legally empower it. And then the next step is, well, if that happens, then how should it be managed?
Okay.
And that brings me to working with real heritage
experts
like you guys at Johns Hopkins and Smithsonian. We're thinking that there may be some of these new mobile applications or digital technology may be a very useful tool. You can imagine. Shall I tell you how about the
process? That would be really great to hear about.
Well, our thought is, from what we've learned about what is already available, imagine a family of visitors, of tourists in Bali who speak maybe Korean or German or English, whatever. They go to the web and they discover that the website, they've heard that the World Heritage is there and it sounds interesting. So the governing assembly, the people who are managing it in Bali, are kind of providing ongoing opportunities for visitors.
Okay.
Gamelan rehearsals in this village, Barong recitals at that one, dances, festivals, religious, all kinds of things, archaeological activities, organic farming, there are many, many things going on. So suppose those are on the web and you can see them and you can say, hey, I'd like to go to that and I'll pay some small fee, whatever they decide, for entrance and perhaps for lunch. And then the phone then will guide you to those places, right? It knows where you are, knows what time it is, it knows what language you speak. And then the heritage experts that I'm talking with now are saying we can also add some content. Maybe even some augmented reality. There are archaeological sites that are interesting. So I'll give you one example.
Yeah.
So there's a beautiful temple where the Balinese who are in the arts go to ask for taksu. So taksu is a sort of charismatic power that art has. You want your performance and you want your art to have taksu. And you would go to that temple, it's up in the mountains, to meditate and to learn and to request taksu. Okay, but that doesn't happen all the time. So suppose you say, that's interesting, I'm interested in the arts. You go there, but that's not a day on which anything much is happening. Well, with the augmented reality, you could have interviews, you could have footage, you could have all kinds of ways in which you'd explain what taksu is about. Even if there is something going on, just a kind of a translation. What is the meaning of it? You know, what's going on in this site?
Yeah.
So what we're hoping is we can develop things like that. So, you know, even casual visitors can easily gain access in a language they understand to general idea about what they're seeing. Because so much of, you know, it's a very rich ancient culture and it's very, most of it just goes by, right? People don't know what's going on unless they can look at it. So that would be a way, these apps apparently, you can easily add content and
it strikes me as a really interesting way to be able to connect the intangible aspects associated with that heritage to the physical, which is often a difficult thing to do when you have sites like that that are inclusive of intangible, tangible, and even natural as well, with the water and the in kind of those systems, a way to be able to connect them all in an outreach component. Yeah.
So that's the thought. And if that all worked, then indeed it seems like it would sort of solve the problem. Then the world, the governing assembly, could probably control most of it. And agencies, government agencies, could play a useful role, advisory role, but the whole system would be pretty much, could be handled by the elected representatives of these villages, and that's what they want. I mean, that's sort of what was promised.
Yeah.
So this could be a tool. This could be really the tool that's needed.
That's an interesting.
That's the idea.
What kind of infrastructure do they have there as far as Wi-Fi, and is that pretty ubiquitous across Bali?
Absolutely. Indonesia has, I think, the highest density of cell phones anywhere, and lots of Wi-Fi. So no problem with that.
So it makes sense.
I mean, everybody has a cell phone. Yeah. And if we need to sort of ramp up the Wi-Fi connections, that's very possible, because that's done. There are lots and lots of hotels now all over Bali, and lots of, you know, there are lots of, basically that infrastructure is already there.
Yeah.
So
well,
it's
fantastic. Yeah, but
the pieces seem to be there.
Yeah, it's
they seem to be pulled together.
That could be, well, and that could then potentially have impact on other similar sites that have similar kinds of components that work together. I think it's important to be able to engage visitors with the deeper content of a site and of an area, which it sounds like this kind of digital engagement would be a way to do. Which
seems like it could work, doesn't it? There is even interest for school children, Indonesian, both Balinese and other. Bali is a place where Indonesian visitors come to. They're actually more domestic tourists than there are foreign tourists. Lots and lots come. And even Balinese children, if they don't grow up in the rural areas, will have a limited knowledge of those regions, those beautiful places.
Mm-hmm.
So you know, all kinds of content could be created and maybe tailored for different kinds of visitors. That's our thought. I'm working with an Asian, what is it called, the Art, Design, and Media school at the Nanyang Technological University, where a lot of people are trying to come up with ways for that to work now. So that's our thought. That's our plan.
Yeah. You think that in part because there was, as you suggested, a bit of a land grab and you know, people wanting to become involved. Do you think they'll be receptive to this kind of approach? Sort of, because it's relocating some of the power to the people, which is part of what the original management plan was, the intent of the original management plan, to have the locus of that power be within the communities. Do you think that's looking like that will be able to, that they're receptive to that, and that mm-hmm. will be able to move forward?
We think it'll work, because it's in no one's interest for the World Heritage to really fall apart.
Yeah.
The situation now is they're kind of opportunistically, some villages try to charge tickets for people to move to come and see some particular view or something.
Okay.
It's very chaotic. It's unsuccessful.
Mm-hmm.
And no one's happy with the status quo.
Yeah.
So, and then there's sort of in the end, UNESCO will send another team to inspect.
Yeah.
And the people are very unhappy now with the failure of the UNESCO World Heritage to bring them any of the benefits that were sort of promised. So we think there's a real chance. We think, in fact, more than a chance. We're going to make it happen.
Yes, that's it. Well, you know, it strikes me that it could, you sort of, as we talked about a bit before, that it really could create a model that could be then translatable in other sites as well, particularly a model that locates a lot of the power within the communities themselves, which is really fantastic when they can benefit from the status. So when you think of the Subaks And could you explain just a little bit quickly what that is? You said the fields and the rice farming, but could you create a visual picture for us what you mean by that?
Yeah, I can try. So Bali's 6 degrees south of the equator, active volcanoes on the island. Balinese have been terracing the slopes of those volcanoes for 1,000 years. On any given river, during the rainy season, the rivers flow fast. They pick up pumice really from the volcanic landscape that gives them a cutting edge. So their rivers are deeply incised on the flanks of the volcano. Balinese dig tunnels down those ravines to lead the water through the rock, but it's nice soft volcanic rock, to networks of canals and terraces. And they've worked out ways in which they can agree to share the water and time the irrigation system so that people, that works. And the case I've studied for several years, it's two rivers and nearly 200 subaks.
Wow.
Are on those rivers. So they are each little independent units. They're about the size of a village, maybe 50, 100 families, maybe 200.
Okay.
But they're not exactly the same as the village because the boundaries depend upon the water rather than where people live.
Okay.
So the subak is perfectly defined. It's completely defined by whether you get water from this particular irrigation source. If you do, then you go to the water temple that's associated with that water source. You meet with the other people. You decide about cropping patterns and that sort of thing. And you also decide about making offerings and, you know, how you're going to acknowledge the gifts of the gods. Balinese have their own religion, which is kind of a combination of Hinduism and Buddhism.
Mm-hmm.
And very crucial to that is the responsibility of people to the lands that make life possible. And subaks are where you make those acknowledgments, make those beautiful offerings, you know, flower offerings and incense and all kinds of beautiful things happen. I mean, there are lots of reasons why Bali is so popular with visitors. The Balinese have a wonderful relationship to their landscape, where it continues to exist. I mean, a lot of Bali has been kind of paved over by globalizing forces, but still quite a lot of it is left. And the Balinese now it's on the news. I mean, Balinese, by now there are television stations in Bali. Much discussion about how they're losing their heritage.
Mm.
It's almost the key. I mean, it's a very key issue for Balinese people, they lose about 1,000 hectares of rice terraces every year. The subaks are disappearing slowly.
Is that through development?
At an accelerating rate.
Is that mostly through development?
Uncontrolled development. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Uncontrolled development. They lose the water. Hotels get built. Water is taken for other purposes, and then the rest of the subak just can no longer function.
Mm.
It's not that big an island, so.
Yeah.
This needs to be fixed
soon. Are they feeling the impact of climate change at all? Is that something that they've had to contend with as far as extreme weather events or access to water and that kind of stuff?
Weather has become quite unpredictable. Mm. The old monthly calendar no longer really works. The rainy season is no longer strictly confined to the rainy season. So yeah, they are feeling. Yeah, and what it manifests itself as is unpredictability of the weather. And that's tough if you are trying to grow rice with ephemeral streams and rivers. They're very good at adjusting to differences in flows.
Okay.
So given a chance, they can adapt. They can adapt. It's a bottom-up system, ideal for adaptation.
Yeah. It strikes me that these ancient agriculture and water management systems are well suited to handle in a lot of ways more than some of our modern systems to handle changes, some of the changes we're facing in the environment.
We've just got an article in Proceedings of the National Academy on adaptive self-organized criticality in Balinese rice or something. And what it shows is just that. The adaptive system actually works beautifully and makes it easy for cooperation to continue because everybody does well. It's not just that most people do well, it equalizes the benefits.
Mm.
And that's probably why this system has lasted for so many centuries.
Are they mostly subsistence farmers, Steve, or do they provide a lot of the rice for the island?
No, the people usually sell rice. It depends on the farm. That's been changing a lot, actually. It used to be, I mean, when I first went there, it was mostly subsistence. Now, They import rice also. It varies. Families that have rice terraces like to keep them, even if not everybody. Now, sometimes there may be a family without anybody who wants to carry on the rice farming okay. tradition, but they can hire sharecroppers, and they do. What they don't want to do is lose that heritage, you know, lose their rice terraces.
Yeah. You've been working in Bali for a number of years, and so you've seen a lot of this change that's happening. What do you see as one of the greatest challenges that they're facing now?
Well, the one I think, the management system is the largest one, the one that the World Heritage is designed to help with. There are a couple of others. There was during the Green Revolution in the 1970s, when the Balinese were instructed to stop growing native rice following their ritual calendar, but instead grow high-yielding hybrid rice as quickly as possible. That didn't work very well. It led to chaotic conditions in which rice harvests plummeted. Because pests could move around the landscape, they kind of build up, and the irrigation patterns became chaotic. They've pretty much recovered from that, but they're still growing high-yielding rice.
Okay.
So we've been very much involved in helping to make possible a return to organic farming.
Okay.
The problem with that is organic farming means that you have to, everybody, not only one person, but an entire subak has to decide to do it. And that means that instead of fertilizing your field, you add manure and so forth, and you wait for soil fertility to build up. That's maybe 2 years. So if you're a poor farmer, you're going to suffer low harvest for a couple of years. So you're going to get the whole village to decide to do that.
Got it.
So that's a problem. Meanwhile, because that hasn't happened, there's too much agricultural chemical flow going down the rivers into the sea, and too much nitrogen. Grows algae that blankets the coral reefs in the agricultural drainages and kills the reefs. So that's an unfortunate and unnecessary consequence of the, you know, after effect of the Green Revolution. I mean, I have to say, the Green Revolution was a great thing in many ways. It kept, you know, it provided a lot of food, but that was a long time ago, and now we have the ecological consequences.
Yeah.
The switch from organic farming to non-organic farming. There's no need to continue with that. It's just a question of making it possible for farmers to go back to organic farming, which is in fact what they want to do. Organic rice sells for a lot more money, and it's much more rewarding.
Yeah.
So that again is part of what we hope the World Heritage Program will allow us to expand. Will allow the Balinese to expand it rapidly.
It sounds like this that there's a lot of potential wrapped up in the World Heritage designation as far as moving forward in the preservation of the traditional knowledge and the landscape. You mentioned it was the fourth attempt at the nomination.
The fifth one.
It was the fifth attempt. Four failed attempts. What was the thought behind the rejection of the previous four?
It wasn't focused entirely on the subaks and the water temples at first.
Okay.
There were several different possible candidates for the World Heritage, and there were misunderstandings about what the UNESCO World Heritage designation meant. The most important temple in Bali was proposed as a World Heritage, but the idea was that meant UNESCO would take over the management of that temple.
Got it.
Led to its rejection. And that's a pity, because that temple would have been greatly, greatly benefited had it been brought under UNESCO World Heritage designation. That didn't happen, however. So now uncontrolled development is the problem around the Great Temple of Bisaki. Yeah.
That seems to be a common theme
in
a lot of places. And tourism, that's another one too that's really complicated. The loving the site to death idea. It seems to me that digital engagement is a way to not only manage numbers, but also engage people with the place without having to be there as well. So sort of expanding that engagement beyond the physicality of the site. And I would think that would work well in part because the site has all this traditional knowledge components as well. Mm-hmm. It's not just the physicality of it, although that's an important aspect of it.
Yeah.
Bali sounds beautiful.
Well, I really do. The Balinese have got some things really spectacularly right, and I think they have things to teach the world. So.
You know, I can really tell just from our conversation here your love of Bali and the Balinese, which is just so wonderful to see. What do you see as the best thing happening right now in Bali?
What I see happening now, I took the head of the School of Art, Design, and Media from Nanyang University. Nice, big, beautiful school, 70 faculty members. I took her to Bali to ask, how can you guys help? And so we just let it be known that we were in the World Heritage Area. And we were visited by an ever-growing throng of people who wanted to talk to her and to explain how important it is and to say, can you help us? Because we want to empower our governing assembly. This is what was promised to us. So she was very touched. Her name is Vivica Sorensen. And I think Vivica's experience just showed this is that I believe that things have changed, and I believe there's really hope that this project can succeed. The other thing that's happening, I think that's hopeful, is there's a problem with rice. It's the largest agricultural contributor to greenhouse gas emissions because it's the rice stalks are little pipes that emit methane and nitrous oxide into the atmosphere. So we've got an experiment going on now based upon work in California that by changing the timing of fertilization and irrigation at UC Davis, they're able to reduce those greenhouse gas emissions by 80%.
Oh, wow.
And we're now replicating that. Isn't that great?
That's
experiment now in Bali. And if that works, it seems very likely that this basic method will work, then that could be scaled up, scale up rather rapidly, because Indonesia is on record as wishing to do that, to reduce the greenhouse gas emissions from agriculture. So if all goes well, that'll be very hopeful. That'll be another good thing coming out of Bali. Right now we're getting data from rice plants. We are measuring the stuff. We've got a gas chromatograph in Bali. We're doing the measurements and it's looking very positive.
Good. Fantastic. Yep. That's great. Thank you, Stephen. This was really great. Thank you for chatting with us today. And I think Bali sounds like a wonderful, beautiful place. Any final words you'd like to leave us with?
Yeah, I'd like to leave you with the little prayer that the farmers say on almost every occasion having to do with the rice. Om Sarva Pranihitankaram, which means Om, may all that breathes be well. May all things that breathe be well. Sarva Prani, all the things that breathe, Hitankaram, be well. So that's my closing note. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Then I snuck around and shook her, cause I went with General Hooker just to fight mosquitoes down in Tennessee. I saw Noah when he built his famous ark. I slipped into it one night when it was dark.